Thanks for listening on Friday, October 12, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today it's the Federal News Countdown. Two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are the three most important to people who work for the federal government for this week. And my guests on this week's Federal News Countdown are John Kamensky, senior fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government. Always good to see you. What is the deal on your leg?
Well, I still have an air cast, and it will stay there for a while, I guess.
And is it healing up? Things are getting better and so on?
That's to be determined.
Oh, okay. We don't know yet. Well, I hope it continues to heal up, and I hope the next time you're here, you're able to just kind of hobble in on your own.
Well, thank you.
It's great to see you, and thank you for coming in today. And my other guest on the Federal News Countdown is the president of the National Academy of Public Administration, Dan Blair. Talk right into the microphone there, Dan. It is great to see you, and thanks for coming in today.
Good afternoon, Francis. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and you have no air cast, so you're 100% complete as you come into the studio.
I am. I've seen John around the academy from time to time, and we're hoping that he's healing properly, but he's not giving his foot any rest. I mean, he's been a world traveler these last 3 months.
He's getting around, and it's
not slowing him down.
No, that's correct. And I mentioned to him when I sent out the little note to remind you gentlemen midweek that your time was coming up, and I said, don't collaborate on these. And he said he was going to see you at a Napa event. So
Do you think we followed your instructions?
I highly doubt it, but, you know, I got to do what
really,
I got to do.
Really, Francis, really? Come on.
And then you got to do what you got to do. Uh-huh. You know, that's just how it works. The stories that the gentlemen have chosen are on this week's Federal News Countdown page of federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and we always start with...
Number three!
Dan Blair, your third most important federal news story of the week is headlined, Attack on Benghazi Consulate Unprecedented, State Department official says... This doesn't seem to be clearing up at all. The more details that emerge, the more clouded the story seems to be.
Well, it certainly was a topic for the vice presidential debates last night. But I'm not hitting the politics of the situation or what the State Department knew or didn't know or what parties knew and when they knew it when. To me, this drove home the fact that our civilian employees on a daily basis are placed in harm's way. And that as we discuss... legislative issues affecting federal employees, I think it's always important that policymakers be informed that our civilian employees just aren't sitting behind a desk pushing paper day to day. Some are, but some are out on the field. Some are protecting our borders. The ambassador was in a dangerous situation in Benghazi, and that this really should drive home to policymakers that federal employees are on the front lines every day. They can and will make that ultimate sacrifice for America. And I think this is something that should inform the debates as we go on into the future about what direction the civil service will take.
I had a conversation this week with a very high-level official at your former agency, the Office of Personnel Management. And my question to this person was, whose responsibility could it potentially be to inform people as we go to this sequestration possibility and the budget cuts and so on, who potentially could be the right person to inform the American people in a non-political, non-advocacy way about things like this? And potentially, I mean, if people thought about Ambassador Stevens in the context of this is a federal employee, this is a person conducting the business of the country on a day-to-day basis, those kinds of things might go some level of distance in changing the perception that people have of the federal government as a whole, I think.
Well, I think that's why I brought this up today, is that we're not taking sides in the debate. You know, we're not saying that there's, you know, throughout the general schedule or raise retirement age or raise the retirement contribution. That's not the debate here. Shouldn't be a debate here. What should inform the debate is that we are talking about people that we ask them to place themselves into harm's way. And if we're going to do that, how are we going to properly treat them? And so I think to me this story and the stories regarding Ambassador Stevens and those others who don't make the news should be that the civilian employees put themselves in harm's way as well. And we should be cognizant of that. We should be appreciative of that. They do that not just for the paycheck, but our patriotism for America, and we should recognize that.
But it's not just in harm's people that put themselves in harm's way. I mean, that people in Oklahoma City bombing did not put themselves in harm's way. The people in the Pentagon did not put themselves in harm's way.
They just found themselves there.
Or the airplane crash in the IRS center at in Austin. I mean, these are people that symbolically represent the government and are being attacked.
Well, I think it's important to remember that they're out, that the reason that they're there, and the reason that they're there, they are there is because they are performing the work on behalf of the American people. And I think that to step back, and when we debate these issues surrounding our civil service, it's important to understand that these folks are out there every day on behalf of the American people. And I think that that should help inform and better structure the debate as we move forward.
Dan Blair's third most important federal news story of the week is an ABC News story headlined "Attack on Benghazi Consulate Unprecedented," State Department official says. John Kaminsky, your third most important story is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is "New Law Cracks Down on Government Charge Card Abuse." There are some things here that, quite honestly, some folks probably would look at and go, why weren't they doing that already? But what did you see when you looked at what's included in this?
Well, this is qualitatively very different than the story that we just talked about that Dan had. But again, it's another form of distrust or attack on federal employees in some ways, that it is a perception that this is a widespread problem. This stems, and the reason I chose this story is that this was an initiative that started under Vice President Gore almost 20 years ago of empowering frontline employees to be able to make micro purchases. And now, today, about 3 million federal employees and military have charge cards, and there's about 100 million transactions totaling about $30 billion. Now, the federal acquisition is about $500 billion, so this shows that it's a lot of transactions but a small amount of dollars. And the thing that I think a lot of people don't understand is the government gets a rebate on these transactions. Last year, it was $326 million, or about $1 billion over the past 10 years or so. And it avoids about almost $2 billion in transaction costs that the agencies would have incurred if they'd used the old system. So there's a lot of savings to the government by using this approach. But, of course, there's always, when you have a lot more people involved, the opportunity for fraud or abuse. And this legislation is trying to focus on the fraud and abuse component of it without, you know, maybe recognizing that there is a real benefit to this, and you need to sort of weigh the difference between costs and benefits from this. And my hope is that this legislation does not wind up reducing the actual benefits to the government.
Now, my sense of this when I read Jack Moore's story from federalnewsradio.com is that he writes about five major points in this legislation. Mm-hmm. And it does. I share your hope that it doesn't restrict the use of this, because the savings of this program has been very well documented. But I didn't take away from any of these five points that any of them would be terribly restrictive. Running credit checks for travel card users, restricting access to those with poor credit, maintaining records of cardholders and their transaction limits, periodically reviewing users to determine if there's still a need for them to have the charge cards, providing training for charge card users, directing agency inspectors general to conduct periodic risk assessments and audits. That all seems reasonable and doesn't seem restrictive to the users, unless there are some users who are taken out of the program for some of the reasons that are outlined, which to me seem fairly reasonable.
And these are basically commercial best practices. So my hope is that the law does not wind up leading to something far more restrictive just in response to this. But in terms of what the law is asking for, it is basically putting commercial best practices into statute.
John Kaminsky's third most important federal news story of the week is Jack Moore's story on federalnewsradio.com. The headline is "New Law Cracks Down on Government Charge Card Abuse." The second most important story of the week from John Kaminsky and Dan Blair when the Federal News Countdown continues on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Tom Kellerman, Vice President of Cybersecurity at Trend Micro, commented during the panel discussion titled The Accidental Insider Threat. Is your organization ready? Brought to you by Booz Allen Hamilton.
We need to also respect the fact that we're seeing attacks or proximity attacks that used to be leveraged by people in the intelligence community are being leveraged through your device. If I hack your device right now, I can then launch Bluetooth attacks against everyone sitting next to you because their Bluetooth is probably on. And I can also pop the microphone in that sensitive meeting. I can turn on the camera in that sensitive meeting. I can get transcripts of what's said. And this is happening globally in the financial sector in sensitive boardroom meetings now.
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen. In today's ever-changing environment, effective cybersecurity takes more than simply implementing IT solutions. Whether the threat is deliberate or accidental, from an inside or outside source, Booz Allen Hamilton's holistic approach enables organizations to adopt a remediation strategy that most effectively addresses their security requirements and risk profile. Learn more at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
For a faster, easier way for your agency to go green, choose GSA's Green Aisles, the custom online purchasing channels on GSA Advantage and GSA Global Supply. Each item in the Green Aisles is identified and labeled with environmental indicators like Energy Star, EPEAT, and more, so you can find the green products and services you need and meet all of your agency's sustainability requirements, environmental and economic. To learn more, join the conversation today at interact.gsa.gov/sustainability.
Today's National Cybersecurity Month coverage is sponsored by Level 3 Communications.
The White House military office says its network was breached in early September by hackers working from Chinese computer servers. Among other duties, the WHMOs, the network some of the country's nuclear strategic commands are stored on. The White House says the hackers didn't access any critical information.
When it comes to protecting your mission-critical business data, turn to Level 3. Mitigate risk, protect your assets, and support the continuity of your business. Learn more at level3.com/secure.
Attention all federal and military agencies. In March, the Australian Defense Force saved more than $150 million by using Intelsat General to put critical communications into space as a hosted payload on one of our satellites, on time and on budget. Our next hosted payload satellite launches in 2013. So if your agency needs on-time, on-budget access to space, take an example from our allies down under and look no further than Intelsat General. Learn more at spacedelivered.com. Intelsat General Hosted Payload Program. That's spacedelivered.com.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. The Merit Systems Protection Board has revised the way it adjudicates cases, and it might be the biggest change in 30 years. We'll hear from MSPB Chief Susan Grundman. Plus, the Food Safety and Inspection Service at Agriculture has launched an online way for consumers to send in complaints about tainted or spoiled food 24 hours a day. Those stories and more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week it's Dan Blair and John Kamensky, and we're up to
number two.
John Kamensky's second most important federal news story of the week is Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com, headlined Agencies Ignoring Billions in Savings from Strategic Sourcing. And John, it seems to me when you get right down to the heart of this story, the concept of it, the reason for it, doesn't have anything to do necessarily with strategic sourcing or with policy. It has to do with mindset and culture and how you convince agencies to do things differently than they've done them before, whether it's acquisition or we see the same thing in cybersecurity and we see the same thing pretty much down the line.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the GAO looked at four major agencies that do spending, and it's 80% of the spending is in these four agencies like DOD and VA, Energy, NASA. And this initiative, the strategic sourcing thing, is why don't you bundle all these small purchases for the same item into a larger program? And the good news was that GAO found that these agencies were doing this, and they saved $1.8 billion. The bad news is they weren't following best practices in the private sector, and they could have saved $50 billion. So that's where GAO is coming down, saying you really need to focus on expanding this. In the agencies that were involved, they said that they found that, at least government-wide, agencies spend 5% of their budgets through strategic sourcing, saving 0.4% total of what could be saved, whereas in the private sector, it's 90% of their procurement goes through strategic sourcing and achieves savings of 10 to 20%. So the opportunity of doing the same mission for substantially less cost is possible, and agencies aren't doing it. And you were getting at the culture thing. The thing that I thought was interesting in the report is DOD was part of the team that set up some of these contracts for GSA and then chose not to use them. They really wanted to use their own. Mm-hmm. So you're right that there is a mindset, and I think that the point at which agencies are going to start doing something about changing this mindset is when they have no alternative but to change business.
And I was just going to jump in and say, what, to get them to change the way of doing business, what incentives need to be out there? I noticed in there that there are a couple of procurement reform bills, one pending in the House, one pending in the Senate. And what kind of incentives should be there in order to change that culture?
That's a very good question. There's been proposals to save hundreds of billions of dollars by using commercial best practices. And when industry goes up to the Hill and says you should use these practices, it'll save you $1 trillion, the answer back is, well, yeah, but that's not scorable. And the question is, well, there's no incentive for them to put the political juice behind it if it's not scorable. Well, the way to make it scorable is you cut the agency's budgets and say, this is how much money you have, and here's how you can go about achieving those savings. That way, if they don't do the change in behavior, they have to cut the money from somewhere else.
Let's and that gets to kind of the way I was thinking about it. A conversation I had this week with a former GSA official was essentially that. We've spent a long time, this person said, with the carrot incentive. Oh, if you do this, here's some great thing that'll happen to you, and not enough of the stick. And what you're talking about, John, sounds more like a stick incentive. If you can't figure out how to make this work, you're going to be in a bad way because you're going to have to figure out what else you can cut to pay for this acquisition that you could save if you did it the way that you're supposed to.
But when we were doing Reinventing Government, we did something similar to this. We said, here's how we can save the government $100 billion. But you have to, by streamlining processes, and here's what needs to be done, and the laws need to be changed for personnel or procurement. And if you do that, then you can have all this amount of savings. Well, what happened was that Congress cut the dollars but never changed the laws to make those streamlinings possible. So it was kind of almost the worst of both worlds because they didn't follow through with what the recommendations were to streamline the processes.
What have you seen, Dan, in your work at NAPA that is a good incentive structure, not necessarily for strategic sourcing, but for anything that's going to change the way, just the typical way of doing business that an agency's always done?
Well, it gets back to the incentives. You're going to change behavior. You can, as you said, you can use the carrot or the stick approach, but you have to have some real-life consequences if they're not going to change that type of behavior. And it seems to me with a federal agency or a federal department, the most real-life consequence is cutting your budget. And, John, you touched on the scoring issue. You know, the scoring issue seems to me is one that cries in need, is in deep need of reform, because a number of things out there are not done just because they're not scorable. They're not done because it's not good public policy to change it. It's done because we may have some outdated budgetary process laws or how we, or our outdated budgetary scoring processes that need that kind of updating. So maybe that's some of the, one of the things that we were doing at the Academy is we have a project, and John's involved in that. It's the Memos to National Leaders. And these are a series of high-level memos to both the administration and to the new incoming Congress on very significant management areas. One of them is federal budget process reform. Maybe these are some things that we need to discuss mm-hmm. further, because you have to change that approach. You have to give an incentive to an agency to change. And if you can't provide the proper incentive, behavior will continue as it is today.
The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by John Kaminsky, is Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com. The headline is Agencies Ignoring Billions in Savings from Strategic Sourcing. And that story is linked, like all of our stories on the countdown, at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan Blair's second most important federal news story of the week when the countdown continues on In Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be right back.
Year was 1957. The date was October 4th, and Americans woke up to a strange new reality. The first satellite launched into space wasn't ours. The Russians had gotten there first. Sputnik 1 may have been the size of a beach ball, but it was the space shot heard round the world.
Today, a new moon is in the sky.
And it galvanized the nation into action. The Martin Company rose to meet the challenge. Then, on St. Patrick's Day, 1958, a Martin-built Vanguard rocket roared into space with the Shamrock taped to its side and put the world's first solar-powered satellite into orbit. 4 months later, the president signed the legislation that created NASA. The rest, as they say, is history. A history that is still being written by the scientists and engineers of Lockheed Martin. Their story is our story. See it unfold at LockheedMartin.com/100 years.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Travel reimbursement rates for federal employees are staying flat in 2013. The standard per diem rate will remain at $123 for lodging, meals, and incidental expenses, according to the General Services Administration. Dan Tangerlini, the acting administrator of GSA, said keeping the rates at 2012 levels will help agencies control costs. He said it also reflects the goal of the administration to cut agency travel by 30%.
WEPA, a nonprofit association, has just announced another 25% premium refund. Since 1996, WEPA policyholders have received 16 annual premium refunds totaling over $65 million. WEPA also offers life insurance at rates far less than the Fegley program. Isn't it time you considered WEPA for your family's life insurance needs? For better insurance, better prices, and better value, visit WAEPA.org. That's WAEPA.org.
By combining HP 3PAR utility storage with HP ProLiant Gen 8 servers powered by the latest Intel Xeon processors, you can lower your total cost of ownership and improve project ROI. GovConnection, a federal elite HP partner, can show you how HP can power your data center into the future. Call GovConnection's experienced federal team, where service and commitment to the customer are priority one. Call 800-800-0019 today.
The Department of Defense update is brought to you by ITT Excellus.
Getting common access cards for military members and their families is now a little easier. The Defense Manpower Data Center is launching its real-time automated personnel identification system. The RAPIDS program lets people get access cards through a self-service portal. Reservists can use the portal too. Data Center Director Mary Dixon says making life easier for military members and their families is the goal. She says the center will add improvements over time.
What is the power of ingenuity? It's a company-wide commitment by ITT Excellus to support our nation's active duty military, returning service members, veterans, and their families. That's why Excellus is launching the Excellus Action Corps, an employee volunteer program to serve those who have served us so bravely. Visit ExcellusActionCorps.com to learn more and join Excellus employees in your community as volunteers. That's ExcellusActionCorps.com.
Pending legislation, federal budget cuts, contracting efficiencies, contract management best practices, acquisition trends, and the relationship of government and industry will be discussed at NCMA's upcoming 31st Annual Government Contract Management Conference, November 5th and 6th in Washington, D.C. Hear from Ted Leonsis, CEO of Monumental Sports and Entertainment, Frank Kendall, Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics, and General George Casey, former U.S. Army Chief of Staff. Learn more at ncmahq.org.
Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by John Kamensky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Dan Blair of the National Academy of Public Administration. And Dan, your second most important story of the week for federal employees is the Jack Moore story on federalnewsradio.com headlined, "Lawmaker Plans Further Delay and Eventual End to Stock Act Reporting Requirement." And this is a story that Jack wrote as part of my conversation with Congressman Jim Moran. And Congressman Moran essentially said to me, this was a bad idea, it shouldn't have happened, it did happen, and we're going to try to make it go away. And it looks like, from what we're seeing, he might be successful in that.
Well, let me give you some background on this. And it's part of a continuum from my first selection, where I talked about putting civilians in civil service employees in harm's way. Congress, back in the spring, in response to President Obama's charge that they passed the legislation prohibiting insider trading insider trading based upon knowledge of the what was going on in Congress. Congress passed what was called the Stock Act, the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act. And during the debate on this, provisions were added that said, federal employees who are subject to financial disclosure, generally those higher paid GS-15s and above, SES, political PASs and presidential appointees, are required to file yearly a financial disclosure, a detailed financial disclosure statement. This statement doesn't have exact amounts. It has ranges, but it also puts in there the trades that were done in terms of assets. You have to list a number of different things. And as under former law, what you would do as a covered employee is you would fill this out. It could be an extensive form. It was given to your agency's ethics officer, designated agency ethics officer. They reviewed it. They had questions. They came back to you. They said, well, last year you put this down as an asset. We don't see it this year. What happened to it? And so to make sure that there was continuity from year to year. And then it would go to the Office of Government Ethics, which was also reviewing it. What they were doing is reviewing for conflicts of interest. As chair of the Postal Regulatory Commission, I filed those, and we had a list of publicly traded companies that we could not invest in because it would be deemed to be a conflict of interest. And I'm sure a number of other agencies and departments have that. I think we had something similar at OPM. And there was a self-policing mechanism in that. But what this provision did is it said, we're going to take that information that you put in that SF-278, and we're going to put it on an online searchable database so that your neighbor down the street, your in-laws, brother-in-law's cousin who wants to, is up in the attic at night searching the web, they can go through and look at these things. And a number of groups out there took pause when that provision was enacted. Senior Executive Association, it was one of the most vocal, but there was also a very detailed letter that was sent by a number of former political appointees in both the Bush and Clinton administration saying this raises serious national security concerns. It was signed by, former DHS Secretary Chertoff. There were a whole group of people who signed this letter, and it was sent to Congress. And then there was also objections raised by a concerned group of NIH scientists. On the other side, we've heard that congressional staff already post their stuff through Legistorm online. There hasn't been a problem. And I think that there is a sentiment among some that's saying, look, there's not a problem here. Why should, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And we are trying to have a transparent and accountable government. And people have a right to know that their public servants are not engaged in conflicts of interest. And so this back and forth that's gone on seems to need some clarity. And that's why Congress came to the National Academy of Public Administration in legislation that passed at the end of September said in suspending this act for most senior federal employees, it said we would like the National Academy to come forward and take a look at these issues involving national security, identity theft, a whole host of the issues had been raised, and say, is there credence to these? And if so, should we get rid of the legislation? Should we come up with findings and recommendations? Do we need to restrict the scope of the transparency? Does it need to be in a different format? A whole host of different questions. And really, I'm very excited about this study because this is exactly why Congress formed the National Academy almost 40 years ago, or 30 years ago in 1984, is because these are very important issues of public administration, and I think it needs some light. There's a lot of smoke and noise right now, but we haven't determined what that fire is. And so the National Academy is going to move forward with the study. It'll take us about 5 months to do that. We will be under contract with the Office of Personnel Management to report back to them and to the Congress at the end of March to come up with recommendations and findings and see if this act needs to be amended, suspended, or enhanced in some way.
The first point is a point of self-interest. Will you promise me when that's available that you're going to come on my show and talk about
Absolutely.
It with me?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. John, I mean to cast no aspersions on Dan and his team because they're very capable and quite qualified to do this report as required in this bill. But what would you like to see as someone who filed these disclosures when you were at OMB? What would you like to see them look at? What would you like to see them explore along the lines of some of the concerns that the SEA and some of the other groups had about the Stock Act?
Well, I filed those even after I left the government because I was working as a contractor in some projects, and that was required there. I don't believe that those were required to be declared under the Stock Act. But the form is onerous, and it does reveal assets that you might not want people widely to know, not necessarily in my case, but I thought that knowing that the agency ethics officer looked at it and the Office of Government Ethics looked at it, it's not like by putting it out on the web that somebody's going to see something that those two officials might not see, because they're looking for problems and they want to protect the trust of the government, to the public. So putting it out, and people can still see it if they came into the office and looked at it, as opposed to just putting it on the web for all.
And you can file a FOIA request and get these disclosures,
yeah,
too.
I don't know.
And you can go to the agency's ethics office.
Yeah.
And be able to
request
that.
Yeah.
But you have to go in person.
Yeah.
You have to fill out a cursory form.
Well, and that's the issue. I talked to Bill Bransford about this a number of times. He's the counsel for the Senior Executives Association. And he said, our objection is that this information is going to be on the Internet, not that the people
right.
have to file this information, because
yeah.
that's just – he said the same things
yeah.
you just did, essentially. This is information that is important for people to have some clarity about what's going on in their government.
And if you talk to someone like at the IRS, senior officials at the IRS, many of them have had harassment liens placed on their property by disgruntled taxpayers. Is this going to increase that? Is this going to increase the risk of identity theft? Or is this just all smoke? We don't know. And that's one of the reasons that the Academy is involved, is that we're approaching this agnostically. And I'm very excited about being able to get involved and look at the details, because these are really serious issues of public administration.
The thing that concerns me is that some senior executives who are in, you know, important roles are saying, you know, I don't need to deal with this. And they're retiring. They're asking to be stepped down to a GS-15 so that they don't have to report. So we're losing top talent over a provision that some see as harassment.
Dan Blair's second most important federal news story of the week is Jack Moore's story on federalnewsradio.com, headlined "Lawmaker Plans Further Delay and Eventual End to Stock Act Reporting Requirement." It's linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news story of the week from my experts on the countdown, Dan Blair and John Kamensky, next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Government technology professionals should prepare to attend GovCom 2012, the trade show featuring government audiovisual communication solutions at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center, November 28th and 29th. Leading manufacturers and solutions providers will be showcasing the latest in audio-video, conferencing, collaboration, control systems, digital signage, and visual display technologies. GovCom will help you boost collaboration, enhance security, improve reliability, and cut costs. See cutting-edge communications products, Get valuable training from leading experts in government and industry, and network with other professionals. Visit Government Video Expo, the leading show for government video and broadcast technology, now co-located with GovCom. For more information and your free exhibits pass, visit govcom2mshow.org and use the code FED. GovCom is brought to you by Infocom International, the Audiovisual Trade Association.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
Join the Coalition for Government Procurement on October 24th and 25th for a two-day training conference, Continuing the Dialogue, at the Crystal Gateway Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. The training will focus on understanding acquisition policy and the federal market. Hear how sequestration, declining budgets, and strategic sourcing may affect what the government buys and how they buy it. Any government and industry professional from across the procurement community should attend this event. Register now at the Coalition for Government Procurement's website, www.thecgp.org.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, and we are up to on this week's countdown.
Number one.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by John Kamensky's from Government Executive. The headline is Democrats Forecast Sequestration's Toll on Non-Defense Programs and Jobs. And no matter how you slice it, this is going to potentially be pretty ugly for pretty much everybody involved. Is that fair to say, John?
Yes. Sequestration is sort of like Russian roulette. Nobody planned to actually pull the trigger on the last bullet, and it looks like, you know, that might happen. And what that means is that $1.2 trillion have to be cut over a 10-year period evenly across every single budget account, with the cuts being equal between Defense Department and civilian agencies. That's $110 billion, $55 billion for defense, $55 billion for civilian agencies. And this is seen as so ludicrous as occurring in the second quarter of the fiscal year. Can't even spread it out over a full fiscal year, that agencies have basically been directed by the White House to don't plan for what the consequences might be. Congress passed a law saying, well, tell us what's going to happen if this actually happens. And so OMB came back with, well, this will be 8.2% cut for, or 8.3% cut for civilian agencies, and listed, you know, 200 pages worth of accounts. And then this will be 9.2 for defense and listed all these accounts. And it's 1.5% for Medicare. And it still feels unreal. So what was the story was about the ranking member of the Appropriations Committee going out and saying, okay, if this happened, here's what the consequences would look like in individual agencies. So Congressman Norman Dix had a report that said that Homeland Security would lose more than 24,000 jobs, and it less said if this were to occur, and that this would be 3,400 Border Patrol agents, 3,400 Customs, 7,200 TSA officers. Now, if you have a hard time going through TSA at airports now, can you imagine what it would be if they had 10% fewer people available to actually do the checking? So this notion of consequences was something that this report that Congressman Dix put together was trying to convey.
I'm not disagreeing with Congressman Dix's facts, because they appeared from what I learned by reading this story to be entirely correct. But I'll get it. I will turn this back to him and his colleagues, and this is a failure on their part to go to the agencies and say, "Please tell us what you do, everything that you do, and then let us decide what it is we want the agencies to continue to do. And I think I've talked to each of you gentlemen individually on this program about that concept of Congress has to decide what they want these agencies to do, and then once that discussion happens, it will be more fair for them to say, all right, if now that we know we don't need you to do this particular thing anymore, then the funding for that can be eliminated, and the people that need to that work on that program or project or agency or department or whatever can be dealt with however it's necessary
but
to deal with
them. But that law was never intended to be fair or thoughtful.
No, you're correct about that. And that's another element that I found interesting. The sequestration, of course, came out of the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Act. Senator Hollings is no longer with us. I've seen Senator Rudman on any number of occasions saying exactly what you're saying. This was supposed to be so ridiculous and so haphazard's not the correct word.
Arbitrary.
Yes, and onerous that it never happens. The people in Congress would say, well, certainly we have to come to some kind of better conclusion than this. I haven't seen Senator Graham anywhere talking about this through the
My question is in the it sounds naive, but it's a fundamental question. Why do we have to enact these poison pills? Why can't we do the right thing and move forward and address these cuts?
You know the answer to that,
well,
my friend.
But you raised the perfect question of why don't we ask the agencies to identify what their – and we've done that through the Results Act – to find what their missions are, to define what their programs are, and how can you better – you know, if you had to cut, how could you make, you know, thoughtful cuts and decide what programs you no longer need to do? You can stratify. You can look at it and say – what do we do by practice, regulation, and by law? What could we shed? None of that has happened. And so I find it very frustrating to say that we have to enact these poison pills because we can't find a resolution as to what the better approach would be. Again, I agree with John. I agree with you, Francis, that I don't think Congress is going to reach it. I think they'll reach an agreement before they go to something like this. It's intended to be, you know, we were talking about the carrot and the stick. This is a big stick. This is a big mallet. It's going to whack us on the side of the head if it indeed comes about. But I think it's time to look at what government does. There are a whole host. We have a mid-20th century government structure. Moving into the mid-21st century. And it's time that we look at how government is organized, what the programs are, and reorient ourselves to an idea that government needs to actually start delivering on the promises it makes, but needs to do so in a much more efficient and fairer fashion.
But, John, you've been right at the core of this, and you and I have talked about your work on reinventing government any number of times, and you have watched from the outside as your friend Robert Shea tried the same thing in the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. We've seen this administration work on reshaping trade, the trade agencies inside government, and they get so far – and they get no cooperation from the same people here that are chiding them for what's going to happen with
sequestration. Well, interestingly, the GPRA Modernization Act has a provision that it basically puts into law what the administration has been touting, which is requiring agencies to identify the 10% of their lowest performing programs. And I've yet to see that list. But this notion of annually identifying the 10% of the least performing programs, I think, could be a
good
strategy for beginning to do this.
It seems like a start, but if you go to the two GAO reports that are out on the duplication across agencies, it's conceivable we could have two or three agencies doing the same thing and doing it very well, and something like that won't show up on those lists. And so those programs will continue without much spotlight on them.
And the question is it really duplication, or are they just doing similar kinds of missions where they could work together better as opposed to working separately? And that gets into this whole notion that we were talking about, strategic sourcing. Why don't you do that with programs as opposed to merely commodities?
Mm-hmm.
And you could strategically source, so-called, a job training network of, say, 10 or 15 different agencies working on common outcomes.
Another item that we've talked about a number of times on this program is that very concept, which is it doesn't matter where something gets done as long as what the citizen that's supposed to receive the services
precisely
receives it the way they're supposed to.
And that's why, to me, it's a question of government organization. And it just calls out for, The Obama administration had put forward some government reorganization proposals. I believe Chairman Issa had a hearing on this back in January. I got to testify. Senator Mark Warner led off the testimony. But I think this is the time is ripe for us to look at the structure of government. As you said, we could have three departments performing the same, same program or essentially the same program. Now, is that intentional? Probably not. If it is, that's fine. Sometimes you need belts and suspenders. But oftentimes, the left hand of Congress has no idea what the right hand does. And so you have an authorizing committee enacting legislation for a program that an appropriator may stick in authorizing language in the appropriations bill. And so what it boils down to is that we really need to look at the basic organization of government if we're going to tackle this efficiency and effectiveness issue.
We could do a whole hour on this issue by itself, and we've got one more story to get to on the Federal News Countdown. John Kaminsky's most important Federal News story of the week is headlined, Democrats Forecast Sequestration's Toll on Non-Defense Programs and Jobs. It's Charles Clark's story in GovExec, and you can read it linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan Blair's most important Federal News story of the week next on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Attention all federal and military agencies. In March, the Australian Defense Force saved more than $150 million by using Intelsat General to put critical communications into space as a hosted payload on one of our satellites, on time and on budget. Our next hosted payload satellite launches in 2013. So if your agency needs on-time, on-budget access to space, take an example from our allies down under and look no further than Intelsat General. Learn more at spacedelivered.com. Intelsat General Hosted Payload Program. That's spacedelivered.com.
Looking for ways to help your agency help the environment? GSA has two free online resources that promote sustainability. With GSA's newly updated carbon footprint tool, you can compile your agency's annual greenhouse gas inventory and track progress toward meeting your reduction goals. And with GSA's sustainable facilities tool and green products compilation module, you can help your agency make sustainable purchasing decisions. To learn more, join the conversation today at interact.gsa.gov/sustainability.
Angela McKay, Principal Security Strategist, Global Security Strategy and Diplomacy at Microsoft, commented during the panel discussion titled The Accidental Insider Threat. Is your organization ready? Brought to you by Booz Allen Hamilton.
That's bringing us all the apps that we want, but we also have to start thinking about how do we then build up the base and enable them to do more secure development through tooling. This is something Microsoft has learned over the course of the last 10 years with our secure development lifecycle, really reducing the number of vulnerabilities and reducing the severity. And that kind of thinking needs to move over into the mobile space.
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen. In today's ever-changing environment, effective cybersecurity takes more than simply implementing IT solutions. Whether the threat is deliberate or accidental, from an inside or outside source, Booz Allen Hamilton's holistic approach enables organizations to adopt a remediation strategy that most effectively addresses their security requirements and risk profile. Learn more at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
What is the power of ingenuity? It's a company-wide commitment by ITT Excellus to support our nation's active-duty military, returning service members, veterans, and their families. That's why Excellus is launching the Excellus Action Corps, an employee volunteer program to serve those who have served us so bravely. Visit ExcellusActionCorps.com to learn more and join Excellus employees in your community as volunteers. That's ExcellusActionCorps.com. FCA Bethesda's fifth Health IT Day comes October 18th to the Bethesda North Marriott. Hear from more than 25 federal speakers on electronic health records, shared services, big data, mobility, and more. Keynotes from Roger Baker of VA, Tony Trenkle of HHS, and Frank Bateman of HHS. Register today at fciabethesda.org/healthitday. FCA Bethesda thanks its sponsors Adobe, CNSI, Dell Tech, EMC, IBM, KGS, KPMG, National Government Services, and NCI.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, this week selected by John Kaminsky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Dan Blair of NAPA. And Dan, one of the reasons I love having you on the countdown, and I tell you this every time you're here, is because you choose something that's totally unexpected, and you have it's a first this week. In the 3 years that I have been doing the Federal News Countdown, this is the first time that someone has chosen a story from ESPN on the Federal News Countdown as one of the three most important federal news stories of the week. The headline is simply, "The Long National Nightmare is Over," and this story talks about Washington, D.C. as...
Well, thank you. I appreciate that lead-in. I think that, you know, we've talked about some very serious topics here today. Talked about poorly organized government, government at risk, putting employees at risk. Will the White House change? Will Congress change? And I really thought that this story answered that. It said the long national nightmare is over because it's talking about the Nationals and the Redskins.
Now, I will give you some credit, too. You chose this and sent this to me yesterday morning, long before we knew what was going to happen last night with Jason Wirth.
You doubted?
I did not know what to expect. Now, John, help me out here because I'm about to be excoriated by our friend here.
I'm sorry. I can't help you.
I thought this was a great story. Now, I have to say that every time the Redskins win a game, you think that we were going to the Super Bowl. And I think the Redskins, it's more hype and hope than the real thing. But the Nats are the real thing. And last night's game was really inspirational. I think it's very inspirational to Washington as a community. I thought this article was interesting. It kind of poo-pooed D.C. as a sports town. I never thought so. I came here in the mid-1980s when the Redskins were at the top of their glory. And it really, I mean, people coalesced around the Redskins. But I'm really glad to see that after 79 years, we have a winning baseball team. I think it was a testament to the city's support. What they had, the largest crowd they ever had at National Stadium on Wednesday. Now, I don't know how many were federal employees who took leave, who took appropriate leave. We could talk about, you know, telework strategies when you're in a crowd of 47,000 people. But you know, all the more power to them because I think this is a great story for D.C. as a city, not necessarily the nation's capital, but I think it really brings the community together.
I wish I had some kind of trophy to give you with a sports figure on it, but I don't for this first. But it is a great story, and it does describe something that, given what we've talked about, not just today, but throughout the past period of time, what the federal government's dealing with and so on, it's a big uplift.
I think it's a big uplift, and not to give short shrift to the Redskins, I think RG3 is going to be a great asset to them. I think it's going to take them a year or two. Maybe I'll be proven wrong. Maybe they can do something this year. But the Nationals, I mean, from being the worst team in baseball to being the best team in baseball, at least its record, we'll see. And I just want to, for full disclosure, this is the most painful series I've ever been involved in because I'm originally from Missouri, and I grew up a Cardinals fan.
And you're choking up now just thinking about it.
I am.
Well, you and your fellow Cardinals fans have plenty of World Series, so you can let us have one this year.
I have thrown my hat into the Nationals ring.
All right, good for you. Thank you very much. It's a terrific story, and I thank you for being here. John Kaminsky, great to see you again,
as
always.
Thank you very much.
You can hear the Federal News Countdown in its entirety at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Hour number 2 is coming next.